This year marks the centenary of the birth of James Baldwin, the great American writer and civil rights activist, best known for novels such as Go Tell It on the Mountain, Giovanni's Room and Another Country. Go Tell It on the Mountain was Baldwin's first novel, a critical success when it was published in 1953, 4 years after he had left behind racism in the US and the homophobia of his native Harlem for a new life in Paris. It was also an influential book for Irish writer Colm Tobin, who read it shortly after his 18th birthday. Colm, whose follow-up to Brooklyn, Long Island, is riding high on the international bestsellers list, has just written a new book called On James Baldwin, in celebration of the writer, in which he explores Baldwin's life and legacy. As well as being a great writer, Baldwin was also a great orator and speaker. Here he challenges white America about what they can do to make America palatable for black people.
I want exactly what you want, and you know what you want. I want to be left alone. I don't want any of the things that people accuse Negroes of wanting. And I don't hate you. I simply want to be able to raise my children in peace and arrive at my own maturity in my own way in peace. I don't want to be defined by you. I think that you and I might learn a great deal from each other. If you can overcome the curtain of my color. The curtain of my color is what you use to avoid facing the facts of our common history, the facts of American life. It is easy to call me a Negro or a promising black man, but in fact, I'm a man like you. I want to live like you. This country is mine too. I paid as much for it as you. White means that you are European still. And black means that I'm African. And we both know, we've both been here too long. You can't go back to Ireland or Poland or England, and I can't go back to Africa. And we will live here together, or we'll die here together. And it's not I am telling you, time is telling you. You will listen or you will perish.
James Baldwin there on one of his many television appearances. And I'm delighted to be joined by the author of On James Baldwin, Colm Tobin. Colm, we can hear there what a great orator he was. He was one of the most politically engaged writers of his time. Give us a sense of who he was and why his work continues to be relevant even today.
He came at the end of the Harlem Renaissance, which was a brilliant period in the life of Harlem, where a great number of poets and painters and thinkers got together in, say, in the 1920s. And oddly enough, they used Paris as the place they went to. In other words, Harlem didn't go to Greenwich Village when it wanted to relax or see it, get a different perspective. A lot of the writers from then went to Paris. So Baldwin was born in 1924, which means that he was going to high school in the 1930s. And some of his teachers were the famous figures such as County Cullen, from the Harlem Renaissance. So he had a sense, not of his own destiny as much as that anything was possible for someone as clever as he was and as talented as he was. So he ended up going to Paris himself in 1948, and he wrote his first novel there. And important things happened to him there. Not only that he saw America in a different light, he saw freedoms in a different light, but he was reading all the time, adding to his store of knowledge. For example, he read James Joyce in 1950. And I think reading Joyce, reading Portrait of the Artist especially, but also reading Ulysses, I think had a very big effect on him.
Now, we'll go back to his work and that time in Paris shortly, but he also played a very important in your own development as a writer. That first reading of Go Tell It on the Mountain had a big impact on you when you were just 18.
Yeah, I mean, even more than Portrait of the Artist did. I mean, in other words, all of us brought up in, you know, the Catholic Church. I was an altar boy. Enniscorthy Cathedral loomed very large in my life. I was in a diocesan boarding school. You know, I took Catholicism very seriously until I was about 16, but it had a big effect on me in those teenage years. And trying to find a way where someone else experienced this and described it and worked out ways of that you were dealing with your, you know, adolescence at the same time as you were dealing with say, not only religious doubt, but religious, serious religious feeling. And that's there in some way in Portrait of the Artist. But the way it's in Go Tell It on the Mountain is there's this young man who's, you know, who's been brought up in Harlem, and he becomes a sort of almost a preacher. But the way in which his church is described is not only deeply religious, sort of soaringly beautiful, but it's also sensuous. It also means that you can sense the idea that this adolescent is actually homosexual, gay, and is trying to work out a way of formulating that and dealing with it. And so I found the novel absolutely riveting. There's something else in the novel that's really important that I didn't notice until I went back years later to look at it, which is that it deals with a very important matter in the lives of African Americans, which is the Great Migration, which is huge numbers of Black people came north in the early years of the 20th century. And they came from the countryside. They were very close, of course, to slavery. And they moved north, not to the countryside, but to the cities, which is almost exactly what the Irish did in America, that in, the people who came from Connemara or Donegal or Kerry didn't want to go into work on farms again. They went into Philadelphia, New York and Boston, which is precisely what the African-Americans did. And for James Baldwin, that past that happened in the American South happened to his own parents, to his own grandparents. It was not merely the past, but it spoke to every moment of his upbringing in Harlem. And Go Tell It on the Mountain deals with not only his childhood, his upbringing, but the sense of his parents coming from somewhere much more horror, I mean, really with terror in it. The yes. terrors of lynching and the closeness to slavery.
Yes, so close to slavery, because there's a grandparent who was, in fact, of John Grimes, the central character in Go Tell It on the Mountain, who had experienced slavery herself.
Yes, and there was also, of course, rape of Black women by white men, which is also in the novel in the South. And there's also the question of lynchings in the South. So all that's there as he's growing up in Harlem. It's not happening, you know, then in the novel as the novel proceeds, but it certainly nourishes and poisons areas of life. I mean, it nourishes the drama of the novel, but of course it poisons life.
But when he went to Paris then, even though he came with all this baggage and knowledge and heritage of his own, it wasn't that heritage he wanted to explore in Paris. It was a European and a European literary heritage he wanted to explore.
Yeah, he has a lovely bit about himself in Greenwich Village. In other words, that he could go down from Harlem to Greenwich Village. But he said of all the improbable people in Greenwich Village, I was probably one of the most improbable. And that sense almost that you're safe in certain places in Greenwich Village, but you go out in the street and the police are watching you and the A train back uptown is the only way you'll get to be safe. And he worried because a friend of his had taken his own life, and he was very worried about how would a writer as talented as he was, a man as witty and smart as he was, how would he survive in the America of his time? So Paris became a sort of obvious route. In Paris, of course, he explores it in his second novel, Giovanni's Room, which is the world of, I suppose, an underworld of gay life in Paris that became easy for him to manage as a gay man. And the characters in Go Tell It, in Go Tell It on the Mountain are obviously Harlem, but the characters in Giovanni's Room are white and they're gay. And so his agent said to him, you can just imagine this. I mean, it's the early 1950s. His agent said to him, could you burn that new book of yours? Just get it and burn it. And his publishers in America said, we certainly won't publish it. So it was a really brave thing for him to do. And he went ahead. It was first published in the UK and then it was published in America. But it became a book where he was claiming, if you want a witness to what's happening in Harlem, don't think that's the only thing I am. I am obviously an African-American. I was brought up in Harlem. I was brought up as a religious person, but I'm also a gay man. And if you think I'm never going to write about this, watch it, because my new novel, Giovanni's Room, is coming.
Yes, and Giovanni's Room is about the denial of love, really. It is that central character, David, who is a white character, and then he meets this Italian man who he seems to be mad about, very sexually attracted to, lives with him. But is he in denial about his sexuality, or is it his inability to love? What are the central themes in Giovanni's Room?
I think Giovanni's Room is a much more religious book, in fact, than Go Tell It on the Mountain. It's a preacher's book. And it's saying even in the most horrible circumstances, love is something that one doesn't have to merely, feel, but one has to actually do or commit to. And the idea of this American in Paris, it's the usual business, you know, plenty of family money, plenty of interest in having experiences. But the idea of someone like that causing immense damage by simply, it's not a question of not being able to love. It's a question of not being willing to love. But there's also a second matter, which is that it's Giovanni's room. It all happens in a single room in Paris. The wider world, these two men are almost invisible as gay men. So it is a political gay novel in one way, but another way, it's a deeply spiritual book about the idea of love, what love means, what commitment means, and also worse, what lack of commitment does.
Let's listen to a clip of James Baldwin talking about being gay.
And the homosexual questions like this, like, it's like what we call the racial question. Nobody, no man and no woman is precisely what they think they are. Love is where you find it. And you don't know where it will carry you. And it is a terrifying thing, love. It is the only human possibility, but it's terrifying. And a man can fall in love with a man, a woman can fall in love with a woman. There's nothing anybody can do about it. It's not in the province of the law. Mm. It's something you do with the church. Mm. And if you lie about that, you lie about everything. Mm. And no one has a right to try to tell another human being whom he or she can or should love.
There's James Baldwin there talking about being gay and homosexuality. Colm, did he come out, or was it a thing of coming out then, or how did it, or was it when he wrote Giovanni's Room that questions were asked, or Go Tell It on the Mountain? How did it become open that James Baldwin was gay?
I think in his immediate circle, it was clear to everyone. And Paris, obviously, was clearer again. But Giovanni's Room, certainly he was, what age was he? Let me think, he was about 30 when the book appeared. So that, you know, from then on, it was very clear. But nonetheless, within the civil rights movement, and especially later with the Black Panthers, there was a great suspicion of anyone who was gay. And certainly President Kennedy's brother Robert did make jokes about Baldwin's sexuality. And there was always a sense of him, being very, very careful not to be only African-American, or not to be only gay, to say, actually, if you don't mind, everybody, there are many other things as well, including, for example, a man.
Now, you said that he came up against his publishers not wanting him to go ahead with Giovanni's Room. But there was also other expat African-American writers living in Paris who wanted him to be pushing one agenda, which was the race agenda.
Yes, it's very close to what James Joyce did to W.B. Yeats, you know, to say, I'm modern and you're something else. Mm-hmm. And to saying to where the young Joyce said to the older Yeats, I'm not going to follow you. And similarly, Baldwin in Paris, he was helped greatly by the African-American writer Richard Wright, who had written the novel Native Son. Baldwin's point was that I need to be able to write novels in which the African-American character or the gay character will not have their destiny dictated merely by their race, merely by their sexuality. And this was, of course, a great matter for Joyce, James Joyce. He didn't want Stephen Dedalus, for example, to be, you know, totally involved with it, with, say, it being anti-British, for example, you know, being involved with nationalism didn't interest Joyce's character, Stephen Dedalus. And Baldwin wanted the same sort of freedom for his African-American characters, that they could be bad, that they could be good on a certain day, that they could be intelligent, that they could be any number of things without having their fate dictated by race, without being beaten to death by the police, for example, or being, you know, taking their own life because of sort of racial pressures. He wanted them to be free. It didn't mean he wanted them to be automatically happy. But this was a big battle to fight, you know, to say, I want to be able, in my own imagination, to make white characters as much as black characters, but also to be sure that I can give my characters a sort of autonomy in their lives that I would like people to have politically, but I want my characters to have imaginatively.
And do you think those decisions he made artistically is what made him such a great writer?
Well, I think he's such a great writer because he's so talented, mm-hmm. and that from then on he nourishes his talent in various ways. But I have to say that, you know, when you watch the civil rights movement beginning and you watch Baldwin, you think, this, you know, there was no other novelist involved with the civil rights movement to the extent that he was. And of course, it became very difficult for him to actually sit down over days and weeks and write novels. In my book, I'm tracing him in 1963, where in that year, he did so much work for the civil rights movement. He made so many speeches. He was on television so much, raising money all the time for the movement, that he didn't actually, as far as I could work out, write any fiction at all in that given year. So there were moments when you could see the novelist and the preacher, in conflict, and also then the novelist and the political figure, and that he was not a civil rights leader, but he became an essential figure for them at various times at sort of formulating in essays what the movement was thinking about, and even going further than that, in something like the March on Washington, he was an important figure in that too. So he became a civil rights activist at a time when no other novelist was involved to that extent in the civil rights movement.
Now, you talked about in Go Tell It on the Mountain about the great migration and the shadow really of the South. When did he visit the South, and what was his experience there?
The South loomed very large in his imagination, but he didn't go there, in fact, until 1955. So he's in his early 30s. He's very frightened because he's being told such things as, make sure when you arrive in Charlotte, you don't arrive at night. Said, what do you mean? Well, it's really dangerous for an African-American man to be seen wandering around. People won't know you. Just don't do that. And he found that there were lynchings still taking place. He found there were murders happening. He found he was constantly engaged, not with the search for civil rights, but with the battle for life. In other words, that people were afraid of their lives down there. And he had not, oddly enough, had not come across this in his daily life in Harlem, and certainly not in Paris. He had read about it, and now he was engaged with it. And I think it made an enormous difference to how he saw things.
And then he became, well, he was always a wonderful speaker and orator, but he became very popular on chat shows as well as more academic occasions where he would give talks. So that orator and that wonderful describer of people's situations, when did that become? When did he become so popular in the mass media?
One of the great things now is you can see him on YouTube, that you can just key his name in and watch him transforming himself from being this very private figure who was known to be witty and private to becoming this great performer. And it's almost like the beginning of the civil rights movement in Ireland, where we were watching figures like John Hume and Bernadette Devlin actually knowing how to deal with the television studio, knowing how to stop for a moment, seem thoughtful, move on. Baldwin became an absolute master of handling a television studio. He could change his accent. I noticed in, for example, that very first clip you played, he's almost sounding posh. He could move into having an almost English accent for a certain moment, just seem above the fray. He had a wonderful way of seeming thoughtful on television. So he went against what the medium was meant to do, television, which is just make things sound quick and almost silly. And he could just stop that. And he could say the most challenging things on chat shows, where for a single moment, James Baldwin would speak a truth. It was not just a preacher's truth, but an actual intellectual's truth. And they loved him coming on because he did something entirely new on the medium. And it's really worth watching him because there's almost, again, no one like him who had that mixture of eloquence, quick thinking and seriousness. He was dead serious about the ways he wanted white America to see the problem. It's not a black problem. It's your problem. It's not. We don't have a problem. You have a problem with us. And if you do, you have a worse problem. You have a problem with yourselves. Solve it. Leave us alone. But he said that so carefully and beautifully.
Yes, and he was a cool cat as well, wasn't he?
He dressed beautifully.
He was
a marvellous figure. I mean, he stayed up late. He loved drinking and talking. He loved hanging out. He had a tremendous smile and laugh. I think he was someone who was welcome everywhere he goes, which is often a problem if you're a novelist. You're often better just to stay home.
Yes, I think Richard Wright gave out to him a bit about his social life and always being out and out with party girls.
Almost everyone did say to him, how, with the amount of traveling. For example, there's a whole life he lived in Istanbul. which is really mysterious, you know. And then he would come back into America. He would go. He eventually settled in the south of France. You know, you have to remember that all those leaders, one by one, were murdered. And he had been on the cover of Time magazine as a civil rights movement. Medgar Evers was murdered. Malcolm X was murdered. Dr. King was murdered. So it would not have been, you know, like certainly was on the agenda that he was someone who was in danger. And he lived in the south of France. I mean, at the very beginning, the Black Panthers, who were, you know, who came after the civil rights movement, were very suspicious of him, especially because of his homosexuality. But later, he became close to various figures in the Panthers who were more militant people. There are the years when Baldwin is much more, certainly late 60s, is a much more militant figure than he had been in the late 50s. But then in the last, I think in the 70s and 80s, he became, I think he retreated very much into having a much more private life in the south of France.
Where would you tell somebody who hadn't read Baldwin to start? I mean, I read Giovanni's Room over the weekend and it is such a wonderful book. But perhaps you would suggest somewhere else, maybe one of the essays or another novel.
Yeah, I would go to a story called Sonny's Blues. And it's about two brothers. One is a sensible brother and the other is the wild one. And the wild one is the musician. And the sensible one goes to watch his brother play. And it's Harlem. And his brother is a brilliant pianist. And you can just watch. And then, as Baldwin describes the music, what the music does, how the music expresses the soul, how the music soars. But it's always one brother watching the other. It's an immensely dramatic story. And I think I would start with that. And then perhaps look at some of the essays in No Name in the Street or Notes of a Native Son, that you can actually see the eloquence beginning. You can see him describing Harlem. He's also a brilliant account of going south for the first time. And he's a brilliant account also of what it means, what it would mean for you or for me. We went into a restaurant and people told us, someone came up and said, I'm sorry, we can't serve you. What that would feel like for anyone. And he's got a brilliant account of just feeling a moment of pure rage. Just not sorrow. Sorrow came later, or just feeling this should change. But just in that second when the waitress said to him, sir, we're not going to serve you. There are times when you think he is the one who described what was happening, I think, best of all.
Now, just before you go, Colm, closer to home, you've written a new libretto, an operatic comedy, Lady Gregory in America, which will be premiered at the wonderful Wexford Festival Opera in October. You're working again with composer Alberto Caruso. And of course, you're going back to your old favourite, Lady Gregory. What can we expect?
Look, I wanted to write a comedy. I'm fed up writing things that are sad. And this is where I promise you, everyone gets married in the end. I know I'm giving the plot away, but it's a comedy. Lady Gregory takes the Abbey Theatre, which he did do, with the Playboy of the Western World to America in 1911 and 1912. And they went all over America. They got arrested in Philadelphia. They got arrested. And John Quinn, the great lawyer, comes down from New York and he gets them all released. And of course, the policemen love the actresses. The actresses love the policemen. Lady Gregory loves John Quinn. The judge loves the widow Quinn. So in other words, it's just a romp. And I promise you, there are no sad songs. There's no melancholy. There's no, oh my God, how are they all going to get out of this? It's just, I mean, I wanted for once to say, could you stop being so sad to myself? And could you just write something funny?
Yeah, you've written a play before with Lady Gregory in it, haven't you? And I know you...
Yeah,
you...
that was a bit sadder. It was about her and Sean O'Casey and they fell out and there was all sorts of sad things in it. But this time around, it's Lady Gregory loved being in America. They fated her. They couldn't believe... She was a great celebrity suddenly. She was out of the shadow of Yeats. No one was blaming her for anything. All the rows of the Abbey Theatre were not happening. You know, she was suddenly everyone wanted to interview her. And her account, because she wrote great letters home. She wrote a book about it. So we have great accounts of her time in America. And of course, John Quinn and herself, there's 1 week missing in her life where when it was all over, she goes and she stays with John Quinn in Central Park West in his apartment. And she writes, we have the letters, the most beautiful love letters to him. She's 60 years old. He's 48. It means there's hope for us all. And she writes wonderful love letters to him when she gets home to Ireland. But the week in New York is missing. I've often wanted to write about that missing week, but just for the moment, all I have is that she falls in love with him and they go off
Okay,
together.
it's like Agatha Christie's Missing Weekend. It sounds
It's
fantastic.
exactly like Agatha Christie's Missing Weekend, yeah.
So, have you any update, filmic or otherwise, on Long Island? We're all dying to know, will it be on screen? Are there plans afoot?
You can never, there's no news now, but I mean, you can never judge with those things. The most likely projects don't happen, and the other ones do. So I don't know where we are with this, but just at the moment, someone's bought the, I mean, the same producer, Fionnuala Dwyer, who did Brooklyn, owns the rights to it. So we'll see what she does with it. I'm going to see her in September.
Right, and are your publishers saying where is the third? Where's the trilogy? The third in the trilogy.
They're not publishers exactly, but anyone who comes on to all the websites and all the, what's it called, social media going on about, what happens next. But as I said, it took me 14 years the last time, so I'll be 83 in 14 years' time.
And you haven't even started scribbling about it. You know, that
Certainly
scene
nothing,
that
no.
came to you for the
No.
beginning of Long Island, nothing like that, no epiphany yet.
Nothing at all.
All right. Well, Colm, thank you so much for talking
Okay,
to
thank you
us
very much. Thank
about
you.
James Baldwin. On James Baldwin is published by Brandel's University Press. Lady Gregory in America is at the Wexford Festival Opera on alternate nights from the 20th of October to the 1st of November. Further details on wexfordopera.com. Colm Tobin, thank you. Playwright Janet Moran and director Colm Morrison brought Quake to the Samuel Beckett Theatre last October. The play was set in a Quaker meeting house and was on the point of being swept away by developers. Now Janet, a well-known actor, is back with her new play Afterwards, which will come to the Peacock stage of the Abbey Theatre as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. Afterwards is set in the recovery ward of an abortion clinic in the UK. Two Irish women, one a married woman of three, the other an 18-year-old on her first foray out of Ireland, and a young English solicitor spend a disorientated night together as they wait for morning. I'm joined now by the writer Janet Moran and the co-director of this play with the director Colm Morrison. So Janet, Afterwards seems very different undertaking to the last play, Quake. What drew you to write about the subject?
Well, the first impulse, I think, was just recognizing that I felt that any representation of abortion that I had seen on stage or TV usually focused on the choice, the before and whether or not to have one or whether or not one could have one. And I just started thinking about the aftermath, the cost of it, what the actual experience of it might be. And I had this image of three women kind of waking up in three beds, like in a Beckett play or something, and just was curious to think about what might the experience be. And that was the first impulse. And then, because I wrote a version of it a few years ago, and then after repeal, I did a bit of research, and there was a Women's Council of Ireland report out in 2021, just a few years after repeal. And that really talked about how the continuing barriers to access for Irish women and how hundreds of women were still travelling to the UK for abortions. So I was really interested in that kind of post the euphoria of repeal and those two brilliant referendums we had, how things are never quite as fixed as you think they might be, or just that it's still accessible. And I think that also outside of the, the kind of the great kind of groundswell of support for repeal in Ireland at the time, the fact remains that I think most women still experience it as an experience of shame and secrecy. And so I was kind of interested in just putting it on stage and having those maybe hopefully more complex, nuanced discussions around it.
And what were the findings of that report? You know, what was it that pressed your buttons to say, oh, yeah, I could see that. How did the characters evolve from reading something like a report?
Well, the 12 weeks is an issue for women. And I suppose with such a kind of a life-changing moment, or perhaps having an unwanted pregnancy, there's only a number of reasons why you might need the 12 weeks. The 3-day waiting period is a real issue for people. And then what really shocked me was there were some case studies in that report. And there was one report of a young woman somewhere in a rural area whose doctor fobbed her off, told her she had to get a scan, cancelled appointments. And then when she did get in to see the doctor said, you're too late. And I suppose for younger women who maybe don't have the financial means, or perhaps married women, you know, who have children or families, it's not that easy to travel. So it just, and then of course the barrister Marie O'Shea's report, I think 2 years ago, really highlighted all that, and was really urging the government to to address those issues. But the play is very much set in the personal. You know, the political is very much alive in it, but it's about personal experiences.
And Colin, what did you think when Janet came to you with this idea? Did you think, oh, maybe this is a bit early, or maybe, you know, why now? Is now a good time to do a play about people who are again in England now having abortions or terminations?
Well, I thought it was typical of Janet's creative courage as an artist that she'd face into a complex and sensitive topic like this. But I read it as I would read any new play and just sort of think, well, actually, how does this work dramatically? And it's just beautifully handled. The characterization is superb. It's moving. It's funny. It's surprising. It's everything that you want in a play. So it is absolutely rooted in the complexities of the issue. But it's not an issue play in any reductive sense. It's a deeply kind of human story. And I just thought it was a wonderful piece of playwriting.
You might introduce some of the character, the three female characters. There are five characters altogether in the play.
Ebby O'Toole Achampong plays the young woman, and she is quite sort of, you know, she's in this situation, but she's quite sort of wide-eyed and naive, and has a kind of a compulsion to keep asking questions. Which the other characters find a bit challenging. Sophie Lenglinger is playing the Englishwoman, and she is a trainee solicitor. So she thinks that she has all this kind of professional aplomb, but she too is in this vulnerable situation. And Kate Stanley Brennan is playing the Cork woman. And her situation is that she already has three children, but just does just says that's as much as she can take. She just can't take any more. You know, so she's made this this difficult decision to travel over. There's two male characters in it. David Rawl plays the young fella, and Siobhan Fulfelly plays the orderly. So it's balanced out with the male voice as well.
Yes, but because there's a protest going out on outside the clinic as well, Janet. We maybe hear them, but we're conscious that they're there, and these would be presumably pro-life protesters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was important. I'm not sure how much that exists now, perhaps, I don't know, in abortion clinics in England, but I know I did find it kind of dispiriting to see people protesting in Ireland outside maternity hospitals where women were going in for all kinds of care. And I just I think perhaps those protests speak to other protests as well that we've seen both here and abroad, and some of those voices seem to be getting louder, and I kind of thought it was important.
Okay, I think we should play a clip from it, because as Colin has established, the three characters, the Cork woman, the English woman and the young woman. And here they're having one of their many conversations.
What was it called?
What? The baby?
What? Fuck no. The movement to get abortion.
Oh, repeal.
That's right. Repeal.
I was there. In the castle.
That was on TV?
Yeah, it was mad. We got the bus into town. Boy, I had Kill Tory, music group, all day. So when me and my friends got into town, it was mostly all over. And it was just little groups of people standing around. Some crying. And in the middle, there was a circle of women all linked and they were singing. We just watched them for a while and then we went home.
Did you vote?
No, like I was only 14 then.
Did you vote?
Yeah, of course I did.
What's your vote?
Well, now, what do you think I voted?
Yes?
Yes. It was a good day. I'd had a good feeling about it beforehand, but still it was a relief.
Why'd you have a good feeling?
Seeing the young women. They're different now.
Different? How?
Just, I don't know. You're better in a lot of ways. I remember when I was a young teenager, even the idea of abortion embarrassed me. Anything like that. Anything that singled me out as a woman. Ugh. Like, we were so clueless, really. I remember going up to Dublin shopping with my mother when I was a kid, and we went into the Virgin Megastore to look at the condoms, because they'd just been legalised. Like, we went in just to look at them. Amazed, like.
That's Kate Stanley Brennan there. She plays the Cork woman. Sophie Linglinger plays the English woman. In fact, Sophie's on the show tomorrow talking about her new Paramount show, Stags. And then Ebby O'Toole Ashing Pong plays the young woman. So as you say, Janet, they all have their own experience of coming. And as Colin was explaining, the Kate Stanley Brennan's character, the Cork woman, is a woman who is married, seemingly in a stable relationship, and has children already, but she chooses not to have another baby. And this causes the other two women to be a little bit uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Inquisitive, at least.
Inquisitive, yeah. I guess I was trying to think of an example that was perhaps outside of some of the more binary things that were talked about around repeal, you know, extreme versions or reasons. And so I thought that was interesting, and that would be as valid as any other choice. So, but the young woman, because she's conflicted in herself and she's trying to reconcile her decision with herself, she, despite the fact that she's really needling the other two women, she's compelled to ask why and how, and like, you didn't have to, so why did you, you know? So the women are kind of forced to defend their choices, like, and, you know, to greater or worse, better success, I don't know, at different times.
And you also brought in some of your own experience into the play.
Yeah. Well, I think you're talking about, your researcher rang us earlier, and she said, oh my God, there's a section where you describe the birth of a child, and she said, it's so upsetting and violent. And I burst out laughing because that's the only bit in the play that's completely true, and it's a description of my son's birth, which to me is completely beautiful and funny. But I think she has a bit more living to do, maybe. But the experience of giving birth is, you know, it's certainly for me, it's the most extraordinary experience I've had in my life. It was dazzling. And so I wanted to talk about that as well. Like, we're complex. It's complex. Nothing is black and white. And those feelings can absolutely coexist with a desire not to have a child, you know.
Yeah, that is the whole trick of it, or the whole art of it, isn't it? To write something that can be politically on the nose, but at the same time be very human, Colin.
Yeah, anything that was purely black and white just wouldn't be true to human experience, and would not make great drama, you know. And Janet's characters are so kind of wonderfully rounded, and they all carry within them the kind of the necessary contradictions that makes a character come alive, you know. But as well as you inviting you to think about those three characters, they also invite you to think about the complexities of every woman who goes for an abortion, that everybody's going to have a slightly different story, and everybody's deserving of kind of empathetic respect for that specificity and that individuality.
As you said, Ebby O'Toole Ashing Pong plays the young woman, and she has a young man who comes and visits her, and we all think, God, isn't he a great fella? But there are ambiguities and difficulties there as well. Can you tell us a bit about his?
Well, he he's doing his best, and he's, you know, he's kind of crippled with embarrassment to be there, but he is being properly supportive. He also feels he is kind of residue of guilt as to whether he did not look after her properly on the night when she got pregnant, and thought that there was very, very improper behaviour from somebody else. So he's carrying his own concerns. I mean, there are, in the wider hinterland of the play, there are some very dodgy men, but Janet has also made sure that some of the characters that come on stage are warm and empathetic too. So even that Janet is resisting any kind of, you know, black and whites of kind of all the men are all going to be wicked and the women are all going to be saintly. That's just not the way she's constructed it.
Yes, nor neither do you have the English woman being the know-all and has everything sorted and is blasé. Well, I'm not suggesting that anybody is blasé about having an abortion, but that the right to have an abortion in England has been going on so long that it's an easy choice. It seems far from it.
Yeah, well, she doesn't have the journey, I suppose, but she still has the secrecy. And she points out, and this is one of the kind of things that amazed me when I was researching the play, is that abortion is not technically legal in the UK. It's de facto legal, but it's only reliant on a liberal interpretation of damage to mental health. So it's not entirely secure there either. And though her experience is different in a way, and also there's cultural differences between her and the two Irish women, the three of them are in navigating the same thing together, you know.
How have the actors, did a lot of issues come up in the rehearsal room around doing a play like this?
No, I think it's important that people protect themselves. And we said that on the first day. Nobody needs to share their own personal story in this. We're doing a play, so nobody needs to do that. So far it's actually been quite a joyful experience, you know, because, like, I think humour always exists no matter what situation you're in, and there is a lot of humour in the play as well, and we're only a week into it, so we're just loving kind of finding the physical language of the play and getting to know each other, and I'm certainly loving watching the three of them develop their performances, and then it's so refreshing and exciting when the two guys come in, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air, isn't it, as well?
Like all actors, they respond really well to great writing, you know, and that's carrying us along in the room.
Well, your play is, tell me about when your play is on again. I know I have it here. Oh, yes. You are on at the Dublin Fringe Festival at the Peacock Stage from the 6th to the 14th of September. And people can get more information from the abbeytheatre.ie.
And we're also on in the Mermaid the week after that for two nights as well.
Excellent.
Anyone can't make it into
we love the Mermaid. We're coming from the Mermaid for Culture Night. So we're looking forward to that. Colin Morrison and Janet Moran, thank you very much. Richard Dawson has been described as a musician who doesn't so much throw the rule book out the window, but as someone who has set it on fire, mixing alt, folk with jazz, psychedelia and prog rock, all held together by his tremulous vocals. Richard will be performing this Saturday, the 17th of August, in the Set Theatre in Kilkenny as part of this year's Arts Festival. Here is a taste of what you can look forward to. This is Thicker Than Water.
At the end, I didn't really comprehend that I was saying goodbye for the last time to all my friends and family. My only thought was flight from the mind.
That's Thicker Than Water from Richard Dawson's latest album, The Rupee Chord. And he'll be performing from that and other albums on Saturday at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. And I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Dawson. Richard, you're very welcome to Arena.
Hello there, how are you?
Very good. Your set for the Kilkenny Festival, I guess, is going to be both songs from this album and like a trilogy of albums you have been working on. This is the third album, Rupee Chord, in a series of albums you have been doing. One was looking back, one at the present, and one looking forward. Is that fair to say or too simplistic?
It is and it isn't. I always said it is a trilogy and it's not a trilogy. And Yeah, I'm not really sure what I'll play at the weekend as well. I know which song I'll start with, and then from there on, we'll just feel our way through it.
So the first album in those series, the one I said was Looking Back, was called Peasant. And that was looking, I think that was inspired by the work of the painter Bruegel. Is that right?
Well, it was in the mix. There was a lot of things in the mix. And whilst I was making it, somebody recommended a Kazuo Ishiguro book, The Buried Giant. And so that sort of was in the mix, a film called Hard to Be a God, and also one of my favourites, Andrei Rublev, the Tarkovsky film. Those were all in the mix. And then just learning a bit about the history of my area, or kind of, well, I'm Newcastle, but, you know, north of Newcastle in Northumberland, learning a bit about that. And it was kind of a stew of different things, but I didn't want it to be a historical album. It really was an album about now and with society, and quite well, back then it seems like much simpler times looking back now, but back then it felt like there was a kind of process of rebuilding or something, some opportunity for a fresh start. It hasn't quite turned out that way, but I don't think we have time to really cover all of that.
And Richard, at that time, when you were looking at Peasant and, you know, doing that kind of research into something that would in turn stimulate the songs, was that a big change from you from doing more introspective personal albums? Not to say these aren't personal albums, but that they're not informed by all the stuff you've referenced there.
Yeah, I think it was a few albums before I'd had this change of when I was first starting out, I was singing a lot of sort of simpering love songs and this kind of thing, as you do when you're a young man. But it was a few albums before I realised I needed to look outward rather than look inward. So I think it was probably two or three albums before that. And this was just part of a process, really. And I'd already done quite a research heavy album with The Glass Trunk, which was a lot of Newcastle history, more closer history, like 1700s and 1800s. So it wasn't such a leap, but again, it was a very heavily kind of research based project.
So Ruby Chord, then, we're looking to a future, maybe it's a warning about the future we could be looking forward to, or we're on the way to. Would that be a way of describing it?
Yeah, perhaps, and the warning is a good word. I mean, even I probably finished it a couple of years ago now, and even in that time, it feels like some of the things I was trying to get out of have sort of crystallized. You know, we're now in this so-called post-truth era, which is a completely bonkers name. I mean, it's completely ridiculous with all the fake news and stuff like this, but also with the kind of saturation of entertainment and more. How can I say? I should have had dinner before I did the interview. I always make this mistake.
I think you're we're learning from you here.
Okay. With things like, you know, Google Glass is now in the home and things, amazing stuff like this. People are able to immerse themselves in their entertainment. And that's only going to increase, and it's going to become more and more part of our lives. You know, things like putting on a pair of glasses, or perhaps even we might have in eye kind of implants, which when you meet someone, you might be able to draw up information about them. You might be able to scan your surroundings, you know, or look at products in a shop, this kind of thing. So all of this is a big change, very profound change to how humans engage with the world and engage with each other.
Yes, and all the things that we may love could just end up in a museum. So we're just going to play Museum, which is one of the tracks from Ruby Chord.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome, dear visitor. The first to our museum. In the dozen centuries since humans disappeared, an archive of futility, miles of hard corridor, bustling with projected.
That's Museum there from Ruby Chord. So that's they're not happy futures you have in store for us, Richard.
Well, maybe there's some happiness on this album, I think, as well. I think, you know, with every generation, it gets so that you hit a certain age and you start looking at the younger generation and feeling something of a loss. And I'm only just starting to get to grips with this. I'm thoroughly middle-aged now. But you start to realise that this is probably the case for every generation, that something is lost, but something else is gained as well. And it's hard for us to understand if we haven't grown up with these things. So I think new opportunities are presented, but also, yeah, there's plenty going out the door all the time, but it's just the way of things.
Well, Richard, I'm sure your fans and your new listeners will have a great time on Saturday next. That's the August the 17th. And that's at the beautiful Set Theatre in Kilkenny for the Kilkenny Arts Festival. Richard Dawson, thank you very much. And more information there from kilkennyarts.ie.